Welcome to the Off the Charts Football Podcast, joined by Alex Vigderman and Bryce Rossler of the SIS research team and Nathan Cooper of the SIS scouting team. We've got Justin Stein with us at always and the champion of the Betway betting corner competition, Matt Manocharian. That's right. Yeah. Fanfare. I know. It was pretty impressive. I made two very conservative parlays. I came through, though, beat Corey March, our good friend, new profile pick. If you check out Corey's Twitter, I highly recommend taking a peek at that. That was the famed punishment that had to come when I laid the smackdown on him. Yeah, got the second parlay done in my five-week run, thanks to those odds boosts. Hopefully a lot of the listeners got to enjoy the fruits of that. Seriously, though, as a reminder, it was awesome having Corey on for the Betway betting corner the last 5 weeks. I'm happy to have defeated him, even though he's an actual better and I am not. But without the boosts from the Betway betting corner, and if you haven't signed up yet, I think that link will still work there at betway.com/off the charts. And you can take advantage of $250 in free bets. So don't miss out on that. Thank you to Corey and the people at Betway. Now for real, though, because I need to get away from the wrestler announcer voice. Let's switch over to today's episode. Today's episode, we've got a few interesting topics. We're going to start off with what Bryce wrote about this week for the 33rd team. Bryce wrote about the teams that had the best and worst decision-making amongst the playoff teams, right? So what can we expect from the playoff teams in terms of how aggressive they're going to be on fourth downs as we get into the super wild card round or whatever they call this much too long weekend that involves two more teams than it should. After that, we will transition to talking to Alex about our week down at the AFCA convention. Alex and I were down in Charlotte at the American Football Coaches Association convention for the better part of the last week, meeting with lots of different college teams around there, different companies working in the space. And we'll kind of recap that quickly. And then last but not least, we'll switch over to Nathan Cooper from the scouting side. And he's going to talk about the NFL All-Rookie Team, the SIS NFL All-Rookie Team, based on input from our scouting staff, along with the metrics, primarily total points. Nathan Cooper and his team, they voted on the All-SIS team this year, and we will announce that. That article is also coming out on sportsinfosolutions.com. Without further ado, let's jump in. Bryce, Alex, welcome to the show.
Howdy.
What can you tell us about these teams? So we're heading into the playoffs this year. As I mentioned, I'm still not happy that there are seven teams that make the playoffs in each side, because I think we have two seven seeds that are just overmatched coming into this game. But that's only pales in comparison to how much I dislike teams with losing records making it to the playoffs. Still got those battle scars from the Beast Quake. What can you tell us about these teams? Because looking at things analytically, we can learn from their tendencies over the course of the year, how they're likely to behave on fourth down, who's more aggressive, who's less aggressive. And not just that, but who's more likely to be the right amount aggressive. Because as you know, it's not just teams that decide to go for it that are right. They can also be right by punting or by kicking a field goal. So what did you find when you looked into some of those teams?
So we should probably preface this with a basic explanation of expected win probability, right? So I'm sure people are familiar with win probability in general. You know, what's the
probability of winning?
Yeah, probability of winning at a given state in the game. Expected win probability on fourth down is a little trickier because you have different options and you have to basically compare like what the win probability is if you go for it and the likelihood you convert, and then you would add that to the win probability if you don't get it, multiplied by the likelihood you don't convert, and then you would do the same for a field goal, and you compare the difference, right?
You have two fairly simple expected value equations, right? As opposed to what the win probability is right now, we have what's the win probability if I get a first down, what's the win probability if I fail on fourth down, and then you can sort of add those together proportionally. And then comparing that to I make a field goal versus I miss a field goal, or in the case of a punt, basically just what the expected yardage on that punt is, right?
Yeah, essentially. The way win probability itself is calculated, but deriving expected win probability added from that is nothing complicated, right? It's basic multiplication and addition and subtraction. So with that out of the way, it's probably not a surprise to know that the Eagles rank first in that metric this year, not just out of the playoff teams, out of everybody in the NFL, right? They rank first by a pretty good margin at 164.4 points of expected win probability added. They've been one of the more analytically inclined teams forever, right? And by forever, I mean within this short period of time that this nascent concept of analytics has existed in the NFL, which is not been right, that long.
Going but up on 33rdteam.com, and you got to shout out one of the founders of 33rd Team, Joe Banner. He started building up the Eagles analytics department first before anybody else in the NFL. So certainly this goes way back.
Yeah, and it's not a long time in the span of recorded human history, right? But in football, it certainly feels like the Eagles have been on the forefront of this forever. So it's not a surprise to see them first. What did surprise me about the Eagles is that in terms of making the optimal decision on fourth down, and this isn't necessarily just aggressiveness, like going for it, right? It's, you know, sometimes, as you said, the optimal decision is to kick a field goal or punt, but they only get it right about half the time. So that was a little surprising to me because they go for it a lot, but there's still a lot of meat left on the bone, even from the most aggressive team in the NFL. I thought that was interesting.
So if you combine that with, so that what that probably means is that they're not necessarily making every single decision on a razor's edge, you know, a tenth of a point of win probability better. But the decisions that they are making are like the quote obvious ones. And some teams aren't making those quote obvious choices. And the result of that, if that 164% means in a short way, like they have a win and a half more than you'd expect over the course of an entire season based on just the decisions they made. And of course, that's just the decision, not the outcome. Right. So this has nothing to do with whether or not they actually made it or if they missed a field goal or whatever.
This is one of my favorite things. And this is one of the things that came up actually while Alex and I were down at AFCA. We'll get into that a little bit more, but it's really interesting. So for only 46% of the time, so more than half of the time, they were quote unquote wrong. However, the sum of all their decisions were a game and a half positive. So both those things can be true. And that's telling you that the positive decisions are a lot better than the negative decisions are bad. And that's how they're creating all of this value. They're hitting on the really big ones. And this is why I tie it back to AFCA, is we're down there and Alex is talking through a lot of the nuances of our win probability model with the different teams that are interested in making better fourth down decisions. And one of the unique things about the ways that we try to quantify it is that we don't just believe in saying fourth and three in that situation, you got to go. And then fourth and four, you got to punt. In reality, what our model probably says in that situation is fourth and one has to be a go. And then fourth and something like 2-6 is actually an on the bubble type of decision. It's maybe within a point of win probability. And then the fourth and seven or more is a really strong, hey, you got to punt it here or whatever the case may be. So sort of understanding that there is nuance and that it shouldn't be just a black and white thing, I think that actually makes coaches a lot more comfortable with this sort of a stat. So that 164 percentage points is much more important than that 46% number.
Yeah, I think that if you're trying to convince someone who is reticent to sort of change the way that they think about fourth downs, and you framed it from the perspective of like anything that's in those small that bubble territory is do whatever you would do normally. But if we're gonna get plus or minus, you know, if we're gonna get a 5% boost on this choice, that's the point at which we're gonna insist on you being more aggressive in that spot, for example. And you can think about it just in terms of like the math, right? If you make one decision that has that kind of benefit and you happen to make some suboptimal decisions that are more on the margins that are plus or minus a half a percent or 1%, you can make one strong, good decision that makes up for a handful of potentially suboptimal decisions that are right on the margin.
Yeah. I think it boggles Alan Manicharian, my father, when we're watching games together or when we're texting back and forth during games, I think it boggles his mind how often I'm indifferent about the fourth down decision-making call. And I go back to, honestly, I go back to my experience as a coach and I think, well, as long as they're thinking about it in sort of the right terms, they are having more information to make this decision than we do right now about this. Maybe they feel like they have a great call here. Maybe they know that somebody's hurt in a way or they didn't practice something well. I really do tend to go back to that. However, when it's egregious, I get really upset because for those ones where you're just blatantly sacrificing win probability and doing something that kind of almost no matter what, not literally no matter what, but almost no matter what the context is, it's got to be wrong, then it's probably really wrong. And that's problematic. But for a lot of these decisions, when you're talking about 1 or 2 percentage points of win probability, yes, we want to get all of the edges, but I think we're kidding ourselves a little bit if we think that the 1% of maths that are in our advantage are more important than any sort of strategic reasoning that we have behind something, right? It would be like comparing two stocks on the stock market and like looking at their fundamentals and seeing like one is 1 percentage point better fundamentals than the other one, and then just blindly using that as your decision. Yes, maybe if you have like a very large algorithm, that's a good way to trade over a long amount of time. But if you're really trying to think about all of the context that might be involved, I think you're leaving something out there. So like the point of these numbers is not to make the decision for us. It's to let us know when we should let them make the decision for us and when we can make the decision for ourselves. I think that's part of the value.
I think that the stock market analogy is a really good one because the fourth down decisions, like Bryce, do you know off the top of your head how many decisions there were total in this sample for the entire season? Like it's not that many plays, I guess is the point.
1600, right?
So we're talking about like 1600 plays for everybody, right? Like that's very small sample of decisions where if you have a 1% edge, you need a lot of opportunities to push that 1% edge for that edge to be reliable. And the other thing that's sort of weird about fourth down decision making is that it is high leverage. And so the difference between success and failure is relatively large. So if you have only a small edge from a probability perspective, each individual outcome actually has a pretty large effect. It's just that over the course of many of those outcomes, it'll come out to a small advantage. So that's why we don't feel that strongly about pushing the really small edges, because you don't really have that many opportunities to make that sort of even out in your favor consistently.
Yeah, just taking a cursory look at the play level summary for the Eagles, it looks like a lot of their decisions where they didn't go for it were in their own territory. We're talking about expected win probability swings of like 6 to 3% are mostly where they're getting dinged. And again, those are in their own territory. So I kind of understand not taking a swing there.
Well, especially considering how often they might be ahead in those situations. And say your win probability is 90%. And if you risk going for it and failing, maybe you will increase your expected win probability because you're very likely to get it. But it might be something like 91% by being very likely, and then there being a pretty unlikely chance that your win probability would drop all the way down to like 75% if you were to miss that 4th-and-1 in your own territory. So I would argue that a lot of those where they sacrificed win probability actually were probably still very rational. They were probably still good decisions, even though they were sacrificing win probability, because in those situations, you don't want to risk more win probability just to sort of raise your expected value. Am I making sense?
Yeah. For example, they have one against the Giants where they were up 10 and their win probability that they went for it was like 83%, and their win probability if they punted was 79%. So they lose 4 points in expected win probability.
But down to 50% or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's basically the idea of if you are in a secure positive position, you have less interest in increasing your expected value. You have more of an interest in reducing variance.
Yeah. It's the principle of diminishing marginal returns, right?
Yeah. basically.
All right. Going back to the list, I think Eagles number one is no surprise. But then we see also number two and number three, I think I'd say equally unsurprising in terms of what we found there, Bryce.
Yeah, the Vikings are second on the list among playoff teams. They were third in the regular season. And then the Bills, not too far behind them, at fourth. It kind of surprised me to see the Vikings above the Bills. But there was also they're also benefiting from one really big swing in win probability, which was actually against the Bills in that game that went to overtime. They went for it on fourth and goal from the Bills' 1 yard line down four. But that's, you know, that's a no brainer. I don't think anybody needs a win probability model or a chart to tell them that. But they yielded like 47 points in expected win probability off of going for that. So when I initially saw the Vikings there, I was kind of surprised. But then when I saw what was happening,
in terms of the big picture,
a huge swing,
it's a huge swing. And this is where, you know, and we'll sort of see this as we look at the list in its entirety and sort of like how all teams on average, the average team is positive in this measure because the average team is making the right choices. And like sometimes the right choice is an obvious choice. And so in that case, like, yeah, we're going to give them a bunch of credit. And it's not so much that we're giving them a lot of credit as we're not absolutely destroying them for making a bad choice.
There's another way of framing this list, which is who is making the least bad decisions, because we are using what we think the best decision is as sort of the source of truth. So fairly put there. Who's the number one, the number two team, the team that didn't make the playoffs that was good at decision making this year, Bryce?
Go ahead and guess.
I'm going to guess the Ravens. No, wait, they're in the playoffs, right?
Never mind. They are in the playoffs.
The Browns.
I feel like I knew this answer.
I feel like the Browns had a lot of good ones with Jacoby Brissett.
Alex, who's your guess?
That means I'm wrong.
You are wrong, yes. The Browns are eighth.
Man, I knew this answer, but I got nothing.
Arizona.
Oh, never mind. I did not know this answer.
And they're not too far behind the Eagles. Eagles, 164.4. Arizona, 161.9.
I'm going to assume that's just because they were behind and YOLO a lot.
That's probably a fair assumption. I would not have guessed them.
All right. Moving down the list, there's one thing that definitely catches my eye in terms of a major concern, but I actually think two of the top contenders in the NFL are two of the bottom three teams amongst playoff teams in decision-making during the regular season. What do you make of that?
You're talking about Kansas City and San Francisco?
Oh, yeah.
San Francisco doesn't surprise me that much, and neither does Kansas City, but I would say that Kansas City aggravates me more. Because this is, for the purposes of this exercise, this is team strength agnostic.
Oh, sorry. They're two of the bottom four teams. I didn't see the Giants at the bottom spot.
Even below the Buccaneers.
Do we respect the Giants as like
of course not.
But so this is team strength agnostic. So Kansas City ranked 25th. Negative 13.5 expected win probability added. And this is very annoying because that number would likely be worse if we include team strength because they have Patrick Mahomes. And we're ultimately, like Alex framed the Eagles as being like a win and a half just off of the decision-making. So this isn't a super big thing. It's not like it's really hurt the Chiefs. I mean, they're the number one seed in the AFC. But it is annoying that you have somebody like Mahomes and you could potentially be a lot more aggressive than you are. And for whatever reason, you refuse to do it. Like even disregarding win probability and just thinking about this, like in more classical football terms, I trust Patrick Mahomes a lot more than I trust the Chiefs defense. The Chiefs defense is a lot better than it has been this year. Or than it has been in recent years this year. But, I mean, Mahomes is the best player in football, and you won't let him go win you the game. Or you won't
give him more opportunities. Well, I mean, that's why I think they've been a lot of close games. They sort of have this habit of playing a lot of games like closer than they should be. To their credit, they've pulled them out and gotten themselves into the place where they should be there. But, Yeah, I'm with you. If I have Patrick Mahomes, I'm basically building my offense to always be going for it in as many situations as possible. And I'm going for two, basically as a default when I score a touchdown, as opposed to when the score dictates it. I'll kick an extra point when the score dictates it, but I'll go for two by default because I want to force you to compete with me for those points.
Yeah, I don't think any team in the league really wants to get into a boat race with the Chiefs. And I'm with you. I would cut Mahomes loose, and if it comes back to bite me, then so be it.
Alex, you got the counterpoint here?
I do actually. We've had this conversation, well, earlier 5 minutes ago, but also I remember in a previous episode we had a conversation like this where if you are I think there are totally viable alternative options where basically you either have an edge in the form of Patrick Mahomes and you therefore want to push that as much as possible, but going for it and being more aggressive, for example, going for it on fourth and two from your own 38-yard line or something, like if you don't trust your defense, then you're putting them in a really bad spot if you don't make. And I understand that you expect to make it more often than average if you have Mahomes, but you are sort of like introducing variability that you don't have to if you're the best team most of the time.
So this, I see what you're saying. This kind of interests me in, it makes me think of like the old Alabama thinking from, you know, like 6 or 7 years ago where Nick Saban talked about like cover one. And his thinking was, we're Alabama. We've got dudes. We don't necessarily need to do anything crazy. We can just line up and play you. And
Jimmy's and Joe's, not X's and O's.
Yeah. Well, and Alabama has more recently transitioned to playing more too high. And, you know, the argument against too high for the longest time was, well, we can't be gap sound. And now their thinking is kind of, well, we've got dudes up front. We can potentially be down a man in the box and we'll let our best guy up front make up the difference.
Also, you can rally and tackle the guy and live to see another down that way. You can't do that if they throw the ball over your head.
Yeah. So I don't know. The point being, I see the argument in saying we would like to avoid variance and just trust that us being better is going to pull us through. But I can also see validity to saying we are better so we can be greedy.
Right. And I think seeing how you actually need to balance that is part of the art, where the art meets the science, I guess, in this case. Just going back to what you said about Saban, I know also he's gone from being somebody who was a staunch believer that he was going to win by having the best defense. You can't score. We're going to beat you. And he openly does not believe that that's possible anymore. That's why they've had all these receivers come through. It's with the rules of football today and the sort of athletes that we have out there. It's not a realistic thing to think that you can just win by shutting people down the way that they did. So I think that's all that also figures into it.
We're also talking about the NFL where like the difference in the quality of teams is a lot smaller than the difference between Alabama and a lot of the teams they play.
All right, but let's keep the conversation college football, flip it towards AFCA. I want to hit on that quickly, Alex, just to see, I know it was your first time down there. For those that don't know, that's the American Football Coaches Association convention. Basically, every coach from college football, from the biggest conferences to the smallest ones, and lots of high school coaches also will be there. It's definitely a job fair for them. They're also looking around at all the different people that are putting products together, whether it be companies like SIS and other, you know, providers in the space, a Real Analytics had a big presence down there for sure. Your Catapults, they are a big sponsor of the convention. But then also everything from equipment, recovery machines, like hyperbaric chamber type things, really interesting locker room, sort of even laundry equipment, really everything you could think of that a college football team or a high school team would potentially need to use to help them run their program. I think it shocked me. Like, I don't know about you, Alex, but I mean, just the number of companies that solely exist to basically just draw different playbooks sort of like automate playbook creation. I think there were what, 5 or 6 different companies that specialized in just that, that were there. It's pretty impressive.
Yeah. I mean, I consistently think about the phrase that I think someone said to me at one point, like that the world is a fractal being like a geometric shape that is sort of like you, it's one design. And then when you zoom in, you see the same design again, and you zoom in even more, same design again. Like the
sort of I call
like,
that the Men in Black.
Sure. Or also people have talked about this in terms of like the coastline, right? If you try to like map the coastline and at the biggest level, you can see the contour that you see on a map of the United States, and you zoom in and you see more jagged edges, and you zoom in and you see more jagged edges. Right. And so like the AFCA convention is a zoomed in portion, and like suddenly you see that there are entire companies for these like what you would think of as being like very specific niches. And there are those people are probably using companies that are their own very specific niches to help them. Right. So it's really interesting to sort of see all those layers. And I also, independent of that, was struck by, I walked in the door and I immediately felt like the smallest guy in the room. Just a lot of thick dudes walking around there.
Yep. Football coaches tend to be big people. So we talked a little bit about, obviously we were down there talking about a lot of what we have to offer to teams. I thought we had some really great meetings with a bunch of the different coaches there. Maybe there were probably one too many conversations we had with a high school team who we really can't help very much at this point, other than maybe conversing with them. Don't exactly have any products built for that level.
But I think that it's good to get those conversations, because that like having those conversations with high school coaches who maybe potentially become college coaches or whatever, like to whatever extent we can sort of evangelize and get people thinking about the things that we think are important, I think that's still useful for sort of like growing the analytics space in general.
You're making me think maybe we should make like a free watered down version of what we do for colleges, for high schools to help them. Like there are certainly, obviously everything's going to be dependent on like the context of the league that you play in. And so what works for a college team is not going to be what works for a high school team specifically. But I think we could think of some clever ways to maybe put some stuff out into the public that could be beneficial. We've got the Syracuse basketball analytics competition going on that SIS is sponsoring on the hoop side, and we'll soon be sponsoring that on the football side coming up soon. Little things like that, putting data out into the universe. Maybe there's some tools that we can put together that are really suited for high school coaches to do just what you were saying, sort of evangelizing.
I think, yeah, that's interesting, because I think about, like, you talk about the league differences in high schools. You got like John Shirley's conference up in Alaska, where everybody's running like the single wing and the wing tee. And then
you've got places that don't even play 11 on 11.
Yeah. And then you've got, you know, you go down to Southern California and you've got a lot of spread teams, and here where I am in Tulsa, it's all 10 personnel, 11 personnel spread in
Big 12 football.
Yeah. It's totally different where you go. And I've got some friends who are high school coaches, and I think a lot of people are interested in this stuff, but a big obstacle for high school coaches is getting like league wide data. You know, it's really hard to build like an expected points or a win probability model if you don't have information for every single play that's been played in your league.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, and you can't even, to the point about like single wing leagues versus spread leagues, like the texture of expected points and win probability is totally different, because the distribution of yards you can expect on a given play is totally different. So like your choice on whether or not to go for it for 4th and 6 in any given situation is totally different if it's running all the time versus throwing all the time.
And also, what's your team strength compared to your opponent?
That part I'm less concerned about, especially if we already have like a college model. Like the difference in talent between college teams that play is not as dissimilar to high school as pro
that
is.
In a way that, how do you do that for high school is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I think if you used, you know, average, you could almost do it as like a 3 versions of like, you're definitely better, you're definitely worse, you're somewhere in the middle. But the thing that I think is a bigger problem is trying to account for just like the likelihood that anyone is ever gaining consistent yards on different distances and that sort of thing.
But if you could get a couple of seasons of just play by play, nothing special sort of data, that's all you really need there. But like Bryce said, that's hard. That's not something that that's readily available all over the place.
Yeah, NFL teams tend to have more money than your local high school program, just what? As a rule.
What else stuck out to you, Alex? Anything else about the conference that that struck you your first time down?
I think that it was just really interesting to see what kind of questions people ask. I think that I appreciated that a lot of the questions we got asked about the win probability stuff, for example, was pretty thoughtful and pretty nuanced, and like understanding that the kinds of things that the model is considering, we can't go too deep into trying to consider everything, but we can improve and sort of create flavors of these kinds of choices that are potentially tailored to different offensive environments, different quarterback situations. I think people want us to care about a lot of factors that are not necessarily reasonable, and it's tough to do that accurately.
I thought it was more unhelpful than impossible. Like it's like things that you could consider, but you shouldn't. And therefore by considering them, you'd give like a misleading, we don't want to mislead people.
Yeah. And I think that going back to the like 1 or 2 percentage point thing versus a larger percentage point thing, like to whatever extent, like the game state information is the biggest thing, or I guess the quality of teams is really the biggest factor. And once you start talking about like individual player effects or, you know, weather effects to whatever extent, you know, like a lot of these things are pretty marginal. And so, yes, you can include them and you might have a little bit of more confidence, but that little bit of confidence might introduce noise in other circumstances. And so like sometimes that information will be very useful. Like if I know for a fact that this team suddenly doesn't have their quarterback mid game, then that's a big deal. But like that doesn't happen most of the time. And so a lot of the other times when we're considering a whole bunch of different factors, you might be just introducing issues.
Right. I was struck by sort of two different flavors of people that I thought were the two main kind of archetypes that we interacted with on the coaching front there. One was the people that really still don't realize how useful this stuff can be. They haven't seen it put into a context for them that matches what they're used to seeing and that they recognize. And I thought, to their credit, there were a lot of people that really it's not that they don't want to know. They know that it behooves them to know, especially I think people of all ages at this point, they know that it would help them to understand. Just sometimes legitimately, they just haven't been able to see it in a way that they see how it's helpful yet. And I think that's sort of fair. And I think we had some really productive talks to that end. The other flavor of person I would say is, I think more what you were just talking about, which is like, how can you make this even more flexible for me? Like, yes, I understand this. I've already bought in that this is valuable. And if I could have this extra bit of flexibility with it, to really personalize it for any given situation that I might come up against, then they're sort of like that next level of coach that's really starting to buy in. So I'm intrigued. I think the age of SIS becoming more and more ingrained on the college front, specifically helping teams win, helping teams make better decisions, helping teams, you know, optimize what they're doing. The transfer portal is such a big deal right now. And I know, Alex, you were talking about, you know, quantifying the value of what our data is compared to what it costs and the tools that we can provide and how much of an advantage they can end up giving you when it comes to injury prevention or making a better decision on the transfer portal or having the right game plan going into a situation. It really sort of pales in comparison. So as people seem to continue to understand how much this stuff can help, I think it's only going to continue to grow.
Yeah, I think that talking to that first category you were describing was illuminating for me, because like I spend a lot of time in the nerd bubble, right? And so I don't get a lot of input from the people who are just kind of figuring out about this stuff now. And so it's really useful to see what kind of pain points they have and how we can.
I'm not asking you to name names, but what was the most interesting or thought-provoking question you got in this regard at AFCA?
I think that I really liked the conversations that we had about the level of detail that you can go into with the win probability stuff and the back and forth of, yeah, we can measure this, but we might not measure it in a way that you agree with. And just sort of like the nice thing about working with game state is that it is true and objective, and everyone understands it the same way. Once you start going into to other layers of the quality of teams, quality of players, whatever, then you suddenly enter into a world of people disagreeing about how to evaluate certain things. And those are always going to be sort of interesting conversations, and you can always improve the way that you're evaluating a team or a player by talking to people and understanding like what does it mean to be a good player or team. But it also can sort of make things more complicated than it necessarily has to be.
All right, Bryce Rossler, Alex Vigderman, thank you. Up next, we've got Nathan Cooper of the SIS scouting team. Coop, what's happening, man?
How's it going, Matt? Appreciate you having me. Always fun talking rookies. So I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about the All-American team for college football a few weeks ago. Now we are on to the All-Rookie team, players in their first year in the NFL that the SIF scouting staff thought were worthy of the first team. Can you tell the listeners a little bit about where to find it and what the process was like putting that together?
Yeah, so for the All-Rookie team, it's just about to go out on Twitter. So we're about to start pushing that out. You can find it on our blog at sportsinfosolutions.com as well.
Certainly, yeah. By the time this airs, it'll be up and running. Yeah,
absolutely. But yeah, going through, this was our first year. We did this for both the All-American team for college, like you mentioned, and the All-Rookie team, opening up to a vote between the ops staff. And, just letting everyone, voice their opinion. All of us watch a ton of football, going through and making our voices heard a little bit while combining with, the total points and some of the metrics that we collect this year.
All right. Without further ado, wanted to ask you, who were the offensive and defensive rookies of the year, according to SIS?
Offensive rookie of the year, we took a shot in the dark here. We went with Tyler Linderbaum, the center for the Ravens. Last year we had a discussion about Creed Humphrey. He had a really good season, had another really good season this year. He could possibly be our offensive rookie of the year, but we couldn't really justify him over Jamar Chase and Mac Jones, two guys that we ended up going co-offensive rookies of the year. But this year, we couldn't say no to the center. Linderbaum's been great. 43 total points. First among rookie offensive linemen, second among all offensive rookies, just behind Brock Purdy, and then third among all NFL centers. So had a heck of a year, second in a lot of metrics, especially in the run game behind Jason Kelce. When you look at the musical chairs that they've had quarterback the last few weeks, he was really a mainstay at that offensive line and helped get them limped into, across the regular season finish line and into the playoffs.
Yeah, I mean, he's knocked it out the park. It's crazy to see how successful some of those early round centers can be. I know we can talk about positional value and centers can sometimes get knocked for that, but I'm a big fan of having a great center and what that can mean for your team. And when you get somebody like him to lock it down in there, like you said, I think he was third overall amongst all centers in the NFL in total points, somewhere around that range, right?
Yep.
Yep. Hard to argue there. Fantastic to see the season that he had. Maybe could argue for I'm sure in the conversation were the two Ohio State receivers.
Yeah, you look at those two guys, Garrett Wilson and Chris Olave, definitely up there, played really well all year. Some even could argue Brock Purdy the last 6 weeks that he had. So
yeah, he led them all in total points just in 6 weeks, huh?
Exactly. So, there was definitely some discussion there, but Linderbaum, just the way he played this year, and it wasn't like, Jamar Chase kind of dominated last year. These guys this year had a heck of a year as a rookie, but didn't have that type of year. So it made more of a justification to go towards the center with Linderbaum.
I'm sure they'd love to play with Joe Burrow, each of those guys compared to what their situations are.
Absolutely. A lot of fun.
All right. Flip over to the defensive side. Who do you got as the defensive rookie of the year? I feel like this was probably an easier one.
A little easier. We went Sauce Gardner, the corner from the Jets, but this is also one that could have gone a couple different ways. You could look at, Tariq Woolen with the Seahawks, another corner out there. He had six picks, did really well. He had four straight games with a pick early in the season. You can even talk about Aiden Hutchinson. While the metrics may not be on that side, he filled up the stat sheet. He put up numbers that we haven't seen in 30 years in some areas there, but ultimately with Gardner.
He put up the traditional stats, but not the advanced stats.
Exactly. So, you look at the numbers, I won't get into it here, but a solid total points numbers led the edges there, but it wasn't as dominant as maybe the 9.5 sacks, the three picks and all of those things were. So, we've talked about this before. He's a high motor type of guy. I think a lot of his production came from that, but the production was pretty outrageous for just being that. So if he can improve and, get a little bit more refinement in his skill set, I think it's something that Detroit would be very happy with.
Hard to argue with his production. Okay. Tell us more about Sauce.
Yeah, going back to Sauce, in no matter the position, he led total points for rookies, 64 total points. A really solid number there. Targeted 15th most in the entire league. But you look at the completion rate against, deserved catch rate against, and the passer rating against, it's all in the top 15 among corners in the league as well. So he was a guy, coming in, one of the top cover corners in the draft. And I don't think there's any denying he's, already trending towards being one of the top cover guys in the NFL.
Yeah, I thought Stingley was having a good season for a while there. Some health stuff, I think, got in the way a little bit. But Sauce, it seemed like he immediately was taking on the number ones from a lot of the high-powered offenses, and they were going after him early. And I think this will probably be the only season that we saw that sort of pattern. I think as teams go into facing the Jets in the next few years, it'll be more like a Revis Island type situation.
Absolutely. I mean, he was targeted 70 times this year, which I would be surprised if it gets over 40 maybe next year, just because, the lockdown ability that he has. I don't think many quarterbacks are going to test him.
All right. So those are the offensive and defensive rookies of the year. Who were some of the closest calls to make the team and or sort of surprises this year?
Yeah, for the most part, if we're looking at just the first team, there was pretty clear cut for the most part. Second team receiver spots, tight end spot, lend itself to a little bit of discussion, some strong candidates in there, some solid guys that didn't end up making it right on the border. But if you want to talk, biggest surprises, at least in expectations, we got to go to Brock Purdy and Kader Kohu. Purdy on the offensive side of the ball, like we just mentioned, 5-0 to end the season, basically 6-0, played a lot of that first game that he came in when Garoppolo went down. But since week 13, highest IQR in the league and tied for the most touchdown passes in the league as well. So he's played incredibly well as the very last pick in the draft. So played really well for a 49ers team, as the number two seed going in the playoffs. And then for Kohu, this guy undrafted out of Texas A&M Commerce, a D2 school, 62 total points, was second among all rookies just behind Gardner. And then looking from basically week 8 on, where he was, basically saw every snap for the Dolphins defense, led all corners in coverage total points and points above average. So two guys that played really well, I think blowing expectations out of the water.
Yeah, I think he got paid about $20 million less than Byron Jones this year and had about 64 total points more. So definitely a value there. Again, part of it, he just racked up a lot of incomplete passes thrown in his direction over the course of the year, being targeted on the other side of Xavien Howard and coming up time and time again with fairly good plays. Be interesting to see going forward sort of how he shakes out in the future, if he can keep up that. Certainly not going to say that he's going to be avoided like a Sauce Gardner will be in the future.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, look at it. He was actually the most targeted among all players this year. He had 82 targets against him. And like you mentioned, only 40 completions against him. So giving up a completion less than half the time when you're targeted that much, pretty solid, especially for a rookie.
All right, going around to the other side again, who are the snubs? Who are the people that either might surprise the readers and the listeners didn't make the team, or that there were heated debates about in the SIS scouting room?
Yeah, honestly, not a ton of snubs, and I'll get to that in just a second. But in terms of a total points perspective, the biggest snub probably being Ed Ingram, a guard at LSU for the Vikings. 29 total points, was actually second among rookie guards, but didn't make any of the four spots. We veered a little bit away from the total points there, and the voting showed that as well. When looking at his blown block numbers, 37 blown blocks, which was actually third most among guards in the entire NFL. And then even looking at his adjusted blown block numbers as well, same thing. Pass blocking, worst in the league, and then bottom 10 for run blocking as well. So one thing there, we kind of veered away from the total points numbers. So, from that perspective, probably a little bit of a snub, but we went with the other numbers. And, like I mentioned before, on a similar note, the one thing that we've done for this team is, for 3 years now, we try to cater the positional structure to the strengths of the draft class. So normally, go to the defensive side of the ball, we would have two interior defensive linemen or two defensive tackles, but this year it was a weak group. So we limited that to one, added a generic defensive line position to really highlight the edge talent that was in this class. So that's something that we try to do throughout and structure it to the draft class. So by doing that, it helps to limit the amount of true snubs. And because at the end of the day, we're trying to get the best players in here. We're trying to feature the best guys from this draft class.
Right. That makes sense. So not having to decide between Kayvon Thibodeau, Aiden Hutchinson, and Trayvon Walker. Instead, there's enough room on the team for all three of them.
Exactly. Try to get all the best guys in there and feature, the best talent from the class.
Worth noting, too, that those guys all performed pretty well. You know, after all the debate about the top of the draft, I would say the jury's still very much out on who the best of them is going to be going forward.
Absolutely. Yeah. All three were the top three among edges in total points, and all were solid in different aspects and different areas. Trayvon Walker was a guy, the athleticism was ridiculous. And he was a guy that played pretty well in coverage. He was a positive points above replacement, points above expected type of guy, and even in coverage as well. So all those guys, I think are, you know, solid picks based on where they were drafted.
All right. And last but not least, obviously the SIS NFL draft site at nfldraft.sportsinfosolutions.com. The listeners can go and look back at the initial scouting reports on any of these players, just like they can look in the old football rookie handbooks for the three draft classes prior to that, to see exactly what the SIS scouting staff thought of all these players, along with a lot of the advanced data that we collect here. In terms of last year's grades on the players as they were graded coming out, how did that compare to what we saw on the All-Pro teams? Was it a lot of the guys that were highly rated that ended up, or excuse me, on the All-Rookie team? Or were there a bunch of surprises and sort of Cater Kohus in the mix?
Yeah, definitely a little bit of a mix. But if you look at the first team guys, 5 of the 11 offensive players we had ranked as a 6.7 or higher, and 7 of the 11 defensive players as well. So when we talk about 6-7 and above, as we've mentioned on this show many a time, these guys were expecting to be solid 3-down starting caliber players by year 2. So a little bit over half of those 22 guys we had is that 6-7 above. So definitely solid to see there. And all in all, whenever you look across the two teams, taking out the kickers and punters, you know, 44 of the 46 guys we featured on our draft site last year. So that basically is meaning that these guys were good enough to at least be backups by year 2 or better. And obviously all these guys making the All-Rookie team their first year is definitely a good sign moving forward for these guys.
All right. Good stuff. Thanks so much for coming on, Coop. And let's remind everybody, they can check that out at sportsinfosolutions.com. It is the SIS NFL All-Rookie Team.
Absolutely. Appreciate you having me, Matt.
All right. On that note, we will wrap it up and get out of here. For our producer, Justin Stein, our guests, Alex Vigderman, Bryce Rossler, and Nathan Cooper, I'm Matt Manicharian, and thank you for listening to the latest episode of the Off the Charts Football Podcast.